Welcome back to the program. Joan Didion once referred to freeways as the only secular communion that we have. Certainly the freeways, our interstate highway system, is the concrete fabric that may be the only thing holding our nation together right now. But how did this system, the largest public works project in history, ever get done? Certainly it could not be accomplished today. Today, when we pay lip service to improving our infrastructure and do basically nothing about it, it's a particularly good time to go back and look at how this interstate highway system came to be. We're going to talk about it with my guest Earl Swift. He's the author of three previous books, including Where They Lay, a 2003 Penn finalist. It is my pleasure to welcome Earl Swift here to talk about his new work, The Big Roads, The Untold Story of the Engineers, Visionaries, and Trailblazers who created the American Superhighway. Earl Swift, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you, Jeff. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you here. I suppose the best place to begin is to sort of shed away what it may be the greatest misconception about our American Superhighway system, the interstate highway system, is that it was not the brainchild or the creation of Dwight Eisenhower.
That's true. He's gotten the lion's share of the credit for a half century now, mostly because I guess he was, it was on his watch that the financing for the system was finally approved. But he had very little to do with that or anything else to do with the system.
And in fact, the origins of it go back to about 1921, as you talk about it.
Yeah, when you look at the federal-state partnership that culminated with the creation of the interstates, you have to go back even further than that, 1916, when the feds and the states first developed a formula for sharing the costs of major road building. And in 1921, that was refined, and they together created the first interstate system. We know it as the numbered U.S. highway system today.
This Federal Highway Act that passed in 1921, talk a little bit about what that was. That was sort of the core of this.
It was. Until then, states and the federal government had shared, as I mentioned, the cost for 5 years of building roads, but there had been no coordinated effort to make sure that the roads in one state that were federally financed connected with those of their neighboring states. And in 1921, the feds created a template for the states to operate in, whereby they could build a rational system and connect all of the major population and manufacturing centers in the country.
And one of the things that was part of that system was this idea of moving away from names of roads and creating numbers for roads.
That's true. And if you go back to the early days of the motor car, when most of America's roads were, if they existed at all, were little more than game trails. They were rutted wagon paths. The first guy really that I start my story with is a man named Carl Fisher in Indianapolis, who in 1912 convinced a group of his friends in the automotive industry to privately finance the creation of an interstate road, the Lincoln Highway, that stretched from New York to San Francisco. And that inspired like-minded businessmen all over the country to get behind road building in their communities. And by the late teens, early 20s, we had a network, a very primitive, mostly dirt network, but an interstate network of what were called auto trails. And these highways, rather than having numbers, had names, like the Lincoln Highway, like the Arrowhead Trail, the Ocean Highway. They reached pretty much every corner of the country.
One of the things that was so interesting is that they were also color-coded, and they were these signs that were on telephone poles that became too crowded after a while.
Yeah, I mean, in the early days, before there were road maps, the first road maps didn't appear until the mid-20s, motorists would know that they were on the right path, the right auto trail, by looking for the signature colors of that auto trail on telephone poles. They painted stripes around them. And each of these auto trails had a signature color scheme, usually two or three colors. The Lincoln, for instance, was red, white, and blue with a black L on the white band. And the problem was that many of these roads overlapped, and so in some stretches you'd have a half dozen or more of these trails all painted, their color schemes all painted on the same telephone pole, and it was painted from ground to 15 feet up, and trying to figure out which was the road you were hoping to stay on became a bit of a dangerous distraction.
One of the keys to the idea of these high-speed roads was this idea of limited access. Talk about that. It sounds so simple today, and yet it was kind of revolutionary as this evolved.
It really was, and it came about a group of a great many thinkers seemed to kind of hit on the idea at about the same time, 1930, 1931. There had been terrible congestion with the advent of the car. I mean, the car just exploded on the American scene in the teens and the 20s. The number of registered vehicles was doubling every 3-4 years, and very quickly it just completely overwhelmed the very limited road system that we had. And they highway engineers tried to settle the problem at first by just building bigger roads, but that didn't work because development along the sides of the roads was a key piece of the congestion. Restaurants, shops, houses would inject new cars into the traffic flow and gum it up. And so in 1930-31, several thinkers, as I said, came upon the idea at about the same time that the only way to make roads faster and safer was to get rid of that peripheral traffic, that ability for people to get on the road wherever they wanted to. And they came upon the idea of kind of a noded exit system, where you were only able to get on and off the highway at particular points, widely spaced in the country, closer spaced in the cities, but limited.
And it was that plus the idea that there should be a medium separating the traffic on each side that really created our modern idea of the freeway.
Yeah, there was a gentleman named Miller McClintock, who was reputedly the first guy to get a doctorate in traffic. He was based at Harvard, and he did a traffic study in Chicago in the late 20s, and he noticed that all of the accidents that he witnessed and all of the traffic tie-ups could be ascribed to one or more of four what he called frictions. And one of them was medial friction, which is the kind of friction you'd run into with oncoming traffic. Another was the sort of thing that you'd run into, intersectional friction, where you'd have traffic crossing in front of you. He figured that if he could build a road that eliminated the four frictions, then he'd solve the problem. And so he set about trying to do that. And the answer he and others came up with was you put a median down the middle so that traffic can't run head on into the traffic coming the other way. And you limit access to the sides and you remove all grade intersections. And those are really the three major elements of the superhighway as we know it today.
Talk a little bit about Benton McKay, who really brought this idea forward of the limited access.
Benton McKay, ironically, was best known when he did this in 1930 as the man who inspired the Appalachian Trail, which he had done in a magazine story a few years before. And in 1930, he wrote a piece for the New Republic in which he advocated eliminating peripheral traffic by limiting access, and really was the first of the thinkers in a rash of magazine pieces that came out within a year of each other to propose what he called a townless highway, a highway that would not provoke development along its shoulders.
And what were some of the early objections to all of this?
Well, the early objections to limited access were that you couldn't get on the highway whenever you wanted to, and people found that somewhat inconvenient when they were accustomed to just locating their businesses wherever they wanted to. The later objections, of course, came when the interstate highway system, financed in the late 50s, construction started venturing into already well-developed, very densely settled cities, especially in the east. To drive a 300-foot-wide right-of-way through a heavily populated city is a tough go. A lot of people find themselves in the way.
Right. I mean, in looking at it now, it's so interesting to see this balance that happened between the impact that it had on major urban areas that existed at the time, and then on the other hand, particularly in the West, the way the freeways themselves created, shaped the modern city.
Yeah, and of course, the distinguishing factor here is the age of the city more than anything. You know, if you small cities of the Southwest like Phoenix, Albuquerque, were really what we think of those cities now. That was a product of the interstate. You know, they Atlanta, another example where the interstates didn't come along after the city was already well established. The interstates really kind of provoked the expansion of the towns into what we know today. So, you know, newer cities like Houston, Phoenix, even the Dallas-Fort Worth area, which were which is a much more compact area back in the 20s and 30s, were really they were made possible by these highways.
And then you had people like Lewis Mumford at the time who really objected to the way these freeways were impacting the more traditional, more established cities.
Well, Mumford's an interesting case because he was one of those early thinkers back in 30-31 who did a lot of thinking about the creation of the superhighway. And he actually co-wrote Benton McKay's second piece on it for Harper's. And over the next quarter century, having beaten a drum for the creation of these limited access highways, he did a 180 and became not only the harshest critic of those highways, but of the automobile in general and what it was doing, particularly in terms of sprawl. Mumford was not a big fan of suburbs and was particularly not a fan of suburbs that just seemed to spread like a stain throughout the 50s, 60s, and 70s.
And in many ways, he was prescient in that regard.
He was it's many of his objections were a bit like belling the cat. He was not big on providing solutions to the problems necessarily. He helped create the problem,
right,
and then came to regret it. But he was certainly prescient in being among the first social critics to say, well, wait a minute, maybe living 20 miles out of town and commuting to work and fighting traffic both ways isn't the model that we ought to be seeking.
The other side of that is that as the freeways came close to these established cities, as you said before, it displaced whole neighborhoods. And generally, in many cases, they were the poorest neighborhoods.
Well, sure. The biggest cost of building a highway is land acquisition. So the these highways tended to be routed through those parts of cities where land would sell for the least, and invariably that is the poorest section of town. And in many cities, especially cities in the East, that tended to be the black section of town. And so you saw a disparate number of black families displaced in the cause of building these things. And that gave rise to kind of a battle cry in Washington at the height of their hand-wringing over the looming juggernaut, that battle cry being that these were white men's roads through black men's bedrooms.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about how the grid came to be the way it was. I mean, it goes back, you talk about FDR, it sort of drew some lines on a piece of paper once that laid out the basics of the grid, but it was really Thomas McDonald that you talk about that was the real father of the way the system ultimately came to be.
Sure. I mean, the grid looks the way it does because buffalo and elk walked the way they did centuries ago. I mean, when you get right down to it, this is an evolution. The interstates, the routes they travel today are an evolution from early game trails, which became Indian hunting trails, which became the first pioneer roads, which became plank roads and early turnpikes, which in 1921 to 1926 became, in Carl Fisher's time, became the auto trails, then eventually were adopted into a numbered U.S. highway system in the 20s. And then in the late 30s, Thomas McDonald, whom you mentioned, who was the chief of the federal road building effort, oversaw a pair of reports that served as the rough blueprints for an interstate road system that would shadow that numbered U.S. highway system. So, I mean, the routes that we have, there's very little pioneer road in the interstate system. In fact, there's only one stretch in eastern Utah that can really say to be a pioneer road in the sense there was no road there before. Otherwise, the interstate systems follow roads that already existed. They might be a couple of miles either side of the numbered U.S. highway that they shadow, but they're following routes that the original engineering was done by animals.
Right. One of the things that is so amazing about this, and that it's very easy to lose sight of in talking about those that had influence and how this evolved, is the sheer scope of this project and the fact that it happened at all.
It is remarkable, isn't it? Nowadays it seems impossible, but this is a system that's 47,000 miles long. It incorporates 300 million cubic yards of concrete, which is enough to fill the Louisiana Superdome of the Rafters 64 times and probably enough to pave the state of Rhode Island. It's it has 55,000 bridges, 15,000 exits. Just the, you know, each of those bridges, those 55,000 bridges, is in and of itself a pretty remarkable engineering feat, considering how much weight it has to carry. And on the same subject, I mean, the system just carries an enormous load. When you consider that the mileage accounts for 1.2% of our total highway mileage in the United States, but these roads carry 25% of our traffic. I mean, it's just a... It's mind-boggling.
And from beginning to end, how long did it take to build the basic system?
Well, that's a tough one to pin down with a figure that everyone will agree on, because some parts of the system were built before the interstates were actually financed. You know, we had the Pennsylvania Turnpike, which was later incorporated into the system, mm-hmm. for instance, and other turnpikes in the east. And coming up with an ending date is difficult as well, but roughly, we're looking at right about 50 years to build the whole thing, 45 to 50.
And this was shocking by today's understanding, a pretty bipartisan effort that went into pushing this forward.
We have to understand that, I mean, we complain about traffic now, but traffic before the interstates were built was just, it was titanic. I mean, there was one... kind of mythical traffic jam outside of New York that stretched for 84 miles. And, so what we deal with now is kid stuff compared to what folks before the war and just after the war dealt with. So, sure, there was great voter demand for an improvement, but our cities were choking. People were mired in traffic for hours, sometimes a day.
What was it like while the system was being built, while the construction was going on?
Well, depending on where you were, it either came quickly or it didn't. The thing about the system was that it was built where it was easiest to build first. So you had legs that would appear. If you were on vacation, for instance, you'd drive from Kansas City to St. Louis, say. You'd find pieces of Interstate 70 completed in, by the late 1950s, and it was smooth going for a few miles, and then you'd be dumped off of the highway for a stretch that was still under construction, and you'd be stuck back on US 40 or whatever, and have to make your way through the old time clogged traffic that you had been dealing with for decades, and really it was like that through the 80s and a good many places in the country where you know, part of your long-distance travel was on interstates and part wasn't. I know when I moved to Norfolk, I could not get through West Virginia on interstates. There was a leg of Interstate 64 between Charleston and White Sulphur Springs that wasn't completed until 1989. And you were dumped onto little two-lane roads in the meantime.
Mm-hmm.
And fought your way over the mountains.
Talk about the interstate as it grew in the West, particularly in places like Los Angeles.
Well, Los Angeles was an early adherent to the kind of the interstate, approach to moving traffic. One of the first interstates in the country is what we now know as the Pasadena Freeway. And, it was a city that is the ultimate city created by the car and by the superhighway, in that it was a very geographically compact, small town until the roads gave people the means to live in Orange County and to live far east of town. I lived briefly in L.A. in the 80s, and it was a remarkably mobile place to be, considering how many cars were on the street. People got around just fine. The system worked. It's now become overwhelmed, and it's almost impossible to get anywhere, but... and whether it could ever build enough highways to catch up with the additional traffic it has now is a question that I can't answer. But for a while there, it worked like a charm. I mean, the interstates, generally speaking, work very well. They do exactly what they were intended to do, which is to move you with a minimum of fuss and a great deal of safety. They're among the safest roads in the world.
Right. Were there those early on that anticipated that they might not be big enough, that someday they would be overwhelmed?
You know, I don't think, I think that if you go back to the late 30s, and when the interstates were conceived, when that first couple of rough blueprints were drawn up for it, I don't think there was any conception at that point that they'd someday be overwhelmed. Now, the guys who drew up the interstates were big believers in the economic viability of roads. A road had to be economically justified or it didn't get built, and an overbuilt road was viewed as much a problem as an underbuilt one. So these were highways that were, you know, they were not lavished in terms of size right off the bat. Most of them were two lanes in each direction, even in the cities, and they were added to as time went on and the demand increased. But if you go back to 38, 39, 40, when most of the real thinking for the system was done, I don't think you'd find any engineers back then who could have predicted the explosion of automobile use and the demand for long-distance interstate travel that we've seen.
Was there any talk ever of making them toll roads?
No, there wasn't. In fact, there was just the opposite. The people who conceived of the system were adamantly opposed to tolls. They viewed movement as a fundamental freedom, basically. And in fact, there was great debate as to whether the turnpikes that some states had been building in anticipation of the system, all of which were tolled, should be allowed to be part of the interstate system. And that debate lasted for years.
Hmm. What about the auto industry? How did they view this?
Oh, I think the auto industry was an enthusiastic supporter from the very beginning. You know, the auto industry has always played a major role, an advisory role at least, in every stage of highway development throughout the 20th century.
And were they actively lobbying for the interstate highway system?
No, they didn't have to. You know, this was a system that was conceived not by politicians and designed not by politicians, but by a cadre of technocrats in the Bureau of Public Roads. And you know, the way that came about really kind of excluded influence by lobbyists. You mentioned that FDR had drawn lines on a map, and in February of 1938, he called Thomas McDonald, his roads chief, into the White House. And he had a map of the 48 states on his desk, and he said to McDonald, "I've been doodling around with the idea of long-distance superhighways," and showed that on this map he had drawn six lines in blue ink, three going north-south, three going east-west from coast to coast. And he said to McDonald, "I'd like to, you know, like you to look into building something that, you know, a project that would approximate these lines. It doesn't have to follow them exactly. And get back to me on whether you think we can make it pay for itself." McDonald took that map and with a large supporting cast concluded that no, you could not make it pay for itself with tolls. There simply wasn't traffic on the wide open stretches to make it work. And that really those six lines didn't make any sense in terms of carrying traffic. Because a road, in the view of the feds at the time, had to serve local needs first. It could not just be exist for long distance travel. There was very little long distance travel to begin with. You know, there was no long distance truck traffic, for instance, back then.
Mm-hmm.
So a road had to serve local interest first, and by stringing together a bunch of local roads into a coast to coast highway, well, then you'd build something that might be worth having. And so he and his people conceived of a network, an interstate network, an intercity network that became the interstates.
And it's so interesting because it's the kind of thing that had politicians gotten involved in it, probably would have failed miserably.
Yeah, it probably would have been a good, you know, surely the routing would have become a huge political issue. But this was really a product of the kind of the progressive era when you get down to it. The engineers who designed this thing were all graduates of progressive era schooling. And you know, the foundation of progressive thinking is that you put decisions in the hands of experts and you have those experts rely on scientific experimentation and research. And this whole system, all of the routing, was decided through research. There was not a single routing decision that was made that wasn't founded somehow on where it made the best economic sense to put these roads.
Talk about the economics and whether there was pressure in any local communities to have the roads go here as opposed to there because of what economic impact they might have.
Well, it's interesting because you saw a real difference in that regard, Jeff, depending on whether you were in the rural part of the country or in a big city. In the rural stretches, early on in the system's construction, there was great agitation to have the roads come as close to town or through town as possible. And so you saw a lot of little towns mindful that a good, you know, hundreds of small towns across America had withered and died after the railroads bypassed them. You had all of these towns agitating pretty vociferously for the interstates to you know, come as close as they could get them. And you saw just the opposite in the cities, where once neighborhoods became politically aware of their power in the 1960s and 70s, you saw them advocating and agitating very actively to move the highways away from where they lived. And in some cities, that stopped projects absolutely cold, in Baltimore, for instance, in Memphis, in Washington, D.C.
And as I mentioned in the introduction, this really was the largest public works project ever.
It dwarfs, if you were to put the pyramids, the Panama Canal, and China's Great Wall together, multiply them by five, they'd still be dwarfed by the interstate system. It's by far the biggest public works project ever.
Earl Swift, The Big Roads, the untold story of the engineers, visionaries, and trailblazers who created the American Superhighway. Earl, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been fun.